25. Mark chanced to look at the Cabot watch on his wrist and saw the minutes falling away. Every mile they travelled seemed to take an age. His fingers drummed on the sill of the GT500's window, and he stopped himself by making a fist. "We have time," said Lucy, without taking her eyes off the road.
"We really don't," he shot back.
"Look, maybe I should dial 911, phone in the threat." Even as he said it, the idea seemed wrong. Give the DC police descriptions of Kadir and the bus? Tell them a tale about kids with bombs sewn up inside them? The cops will think you're insane. Lucy shook her head. "The only way they're going to take you seriously is if you give them your name, and that'll connect with whatever Interpol warrant MI6 has with your smiling face on it. You're an international fugitive, which makes it pretty unlikely anyone is going to listen to you." He studied her. "So you make the call then." Lucy's jaw stiffened. "That ain't gonna happen."
"Why?"
Mark pressed, sensing that she was holding something back from him. The same vibe he'd got on the road in Turkey. Apart from the whole pretending to be a federal agent bit back at the diner, what's stopping you from contacting someone in Washington? Someone from your army service? Lucy, come on.
No.
She shut him down hard. "Okay, you want to know why? Because I'm on a wanted list too. See, the U.S. Army and me, we didn't exactly part on good terms." He opened his mouth to speak, but Lucy cut him off. "And I will not elaborate because it's none of your goddamned business."
"So," he said after a moment, "up to us then."
Lucy pulled off 13th Street and slipped the Mustang into an underground car park below a shopping mall. As the engine died, she sat there and listened to the echo of the concrete space, the growl of other cars coming and going. She fished a pair of sunglasses from the top pocket of her jacket and put them on, flashing a look at her reflection in the rear view to see if they concealed the new shiner she was growing. Good enough, she decided, and checked the loads in her Walther semi-automatic before settling it into a shoulder holster. Mark was doing the same thing, easing back the slide on the Glock to make sure he had a bullet in the pipe. "We'll walk and talk," she told him, reaching for the door handle. He jutted his chin at the car.
"We're just going to leave the HMX we pulled out of that kid."
"We sure as hell are not taking it with us." She walked on, and neither of them mentioned the ever-decreasing countdown. They both understood what missing it would mean. Mark dragged his battered day pack up and hung it over one shoulder, hunching into it as he walked. "Should probably split up," he said, as they approached the door out to the sidewalk. "More chance of spotting the bus that way." She was going to agree, but then they emerged into the bright daylight on the corner of F Street to see a convoy of identical school buses heading in the opposite direction.
Or not.
In every direction, Lucy saw coaches, buses, and school vehicles. More than that, the streets between Metro Center and the Federal Triangle were choked with dozens of groups of teenage students on top of the city's usual load of transient tourists and day trippers. They moved in flocks, behind harried teachers, each cluster color-coded by college sweatshirts or fluorescent backpacks. "Needle, meet Haystack," muttered Mark. "Everyone and their dog has come out today." "Keep moving," she told him. They crossed down to Pennsylvania Avenue, and Lucy's own threat radar went off as she saw the uptick in the numbers of uniformed police officers. Blue sawhorses were arranged to slow traffic and manage the flow of vehicles and pedestrians into channels that the DCPD could watch, and if the need arose, cut off. Trailing a group of people carrying pro-presidential placards for the rally, they turned west, and Mark pointed out a striking white Beaux Arts building on the corner. "The Willard Hotel. Little upmarket for my tastes, to be honest." She frowned. "It's a landmark. It could just be that, a waypoint." He shot her a look. "It's also one of the tallest buildings in the area. If you're planning a strike, it's got a good view of the target zone." He jerked his thumb over his shoulder. The temporary stage where the rally's speeches would be given was a few blocks to the east. A whole section of the National Mall in front of the Capitol building and its reflecting pool had been cordoned off between 3rd and 7th Street. From the top of the Willard, an observer would have a clear line of sight over the roofs of the Internal Revenue and legislative affairs buildings in the so-called Federal Triangle. I'll check it out. You take Pershing Park across the street. Or, she halted, and a weight of certainty settled on her. Or I don't do that. Lucy looked around at the civilians moving past them, and she could hear the sounds of a boisterous brass section where the band of the United States Marine Corps were playing The Circus Bee to the waiting crowds. She had been entertaining the possibility that the two of them could find a way to isolate the Al-Saif cell, but as she saw the people, the numbers, that seemed more and more like pinning their hopes on blind luck. "This is not a time to be cryptic," Mark told her. Lucy shook her head. "I mean, you were right. I can make a call. Get more eyes on this." Her mind flashed back to the ugly mess of red she had seen inside that poor Arab kid's belly, the callous device and the ugly potential within it. A dozen more of those could turn this peaceful gathering into a day of hell. "You'll be in cuffs," 10 seconds later. "Likely," she said sharply. "But my liberty is a small price to pay if we can flag Kadir and his soldier boys." "You sure?" He actually sounded worried for her, and Lucy found that oddly touching. But she was already walking away. Now she'd committed to the choice, she felt no doubts about it. "Get up there," said Lucy, jabbing her finger at the Willard's ornate parapets. "And do some of that clever shit you're good at." Jadid lined up the youths in front of the school bus. They had been given tea and hot food, woken from their fitful slumber for a last meal. Kadir did not tell them it was so, of course. Now it was just them. Kadir, his second, and the American with the dead eyes and expressionless face, the one called Teep. All the others were gone, and he had not been sorry to see the arrogant Britisher leave for the observation point with the South African. The warehouse had an expectant air that reminded Kadir of a mosque in the moments before a service began. He walked the line of young men, measuring the balance of their confidence. It was to their credit that none of them showed weakness. Cutting the boy Halil from the crop had made sure that would not happen. He had served his purpose as a lesson, and the others had learned it well. Jadid offered a tight nod. "Ready for final deployment." He returned the nod and gestured to the American. "Wait inside the bus." Teep climbed into the vehicle, indifferent to the weight of the moment taking place around him. Kadir turned his gaze on the youths. "We are here," he began, speaking in Arabic, "in the heart of enemy territory. America is a great beast, asleep as we walk softly through its domains. In the past, that beast has lashed out at us, but it is a foolish, imbecilic animal, slow and ponderous. It does not see us coming, my brothers." He saw some of them react. He had never called them brothers before this moment, and they understood the consequences of being granted that status. "Today, we will strike a blow of great force. It will sound around the world. Every enemy will recoil in its wake. You are the bringers of glory, and after today you will be undying." He paused and brought his hands together. "Much has been asked of you, but you have not faltered. You make Al-Saif proud, my brothers. You make me proud." The youth closest to him, the lanky teenager called Adad, looked up with shining eyes. His words fell on fertile ground, emboldening the young troop of soon-to-be Shahiden. Kadir wondered if they really did understand the fate that was unfolding before them. It mattered little at this point. The training at the orphanage had beaten the questions out of them long ago, forged them into soldiers that would obey willingly. Al-Saif had made them anew, he reflected. "You're not going to be doing any dying today." The Britisher's mocking words came back to him as he studied their faces, and Kadir looked inside himself, searching for any spark of guilt at the plan he had set in motion. He found none. "The strike you lead this day will eclipse all others," he said, closing the speech with a respectful nod. "Go to it, brothers, and take a man's revenge on those who have wronged you." He stood by the door and bowed to them as they boarded the bus, ending with a final handshake to Jadid. "Inshallah," said the other man.
Nothing can stop us now, sir. From your lips to heaven's ears, Kadir replied, although he shared little belief in higher powers. You know what to do. Position the weapons and then disengage. We will meet again at the rendezvous, yes? Paris, in 5 days, agreed Jadid. Then we begin our next endeavor.
Kadir stepped away, slapping the control button to retract the roller door and allow the bus to drive away. He gave each of the teenagers who dared to meet his eyes through the window the same fatherly gaze, and then they were gone. He waited for the sound of the engine to fade and walked to the far corner of the warehouse, where a tarpaulin covered a Volkswagen Jetta. He threw aside the cover and climbed into the rental car, finding the keys on the seat, along with a one-way ticket on KLM's mid-morning service to Charles de Gaulle. Kadir glanced at the clock on the Jetta's dash, then at the timer app on his smartphone. His flight would be taking off shortly before the detonations, and he could not risk missing the departure. Every aircraft out of Washington, D.C., not already in the air, would be grounded within moments of the attack, and he had no wish to be trapped in this country while their lawmen picked through the debris. He donned a wig and eyeglasses, rubbing makeup into his cheeks to make his face appear lighter. His false smile became genuine as he drove off. By the time he deplaned in France, Omar Kadir would be responsible for redrawing the world in blood and in flames. Mark's attire was inappropriate for the Willards' more exclusive clientele. A dark jacket of military cut over a mix of tactical gear from the night before. But rather than brave whatever hawkish concierge patrolled the lobby, he slipped down the side street and made for the service entrance. Parked outside was a line of trucks, each bearing the logo of a different international broadcaster. Thick black cables snaked away under plastic covers, leading toward the press gallery a block distant. Inside the Willard, away from the gaze of the hotel's well-heeled guests, tech crews were setting up their equipment to broadcast the president's address live to millions of viewers. He aimed himself at a woman exiting the building, the tag of a laminated security pass dangling from her jacket pocket, and deliberately brushed too close to her. Sorry, he said, throwing a smile back at her without losing a step. She scowled and walked on, unaware that her pass was now in Mark's hand. He tucked it in his jacket collar, using the lapel to hide the picture. He jogged across the Willard's loading bay, ignored by one of the hotel's security guards, and squeezed into a freight elevator as the door was closing. Two men were already inside, each wearing technician's tool vests. They gave Mark a cursory glance and continued their conversation. The younger man was in the middle of complaining about something. It makes work for all of us, he was saying. It would be way easier if we could just use wireless. The other man gave a rueful, seen-it-all shrug. Don't mess with the government, he said. You work in this town long enough. You realize that's rule numero uno. He looked at Mark again. Hey, you just get in? Mark's pass bore the logo of BBC, so for once he could drop the accent. Yeah, off the red eye from London. You look it, said the younger man, taking in the fatigue that colored his expression. There's a rack in back of the comms room. Thanks, Mark said with a wan smile. Can't do that, though, he shrugged. Got a job to do. That earned him a comradely nod from the techs. I hate it when this shit happens, man, continued the younger one. 9 times out of 10 it's a false alarm. That caught Mark's attention. What do you mean? They tightened up security this morning, said the other man. Something about an alert. Heard it was about some ship, said the young technician. In New Jersey. Got Homeland Security rattled. Really? Mark tried to seem nonchalant. The elevator clanked to a halt and the two men got off, pushing a trolley between them. You coming? Said the older man. Mark shook his head. I'll catch you later. The door closed again, and he tapped the button that would take him to the top floor. In his head, he was sketching a map, drawing on what he had seen on his web search as they drove in. Mark believed his guess about the Willard serving as a vantage point was sound. The other options didn't sync up. It was too far away from the rally for the deployment of any other kind of weapon, too public to be an operating base for the Al-Saif attack cell, but it was close enough to monitor the progress of any act of terror and just far enough away to be on the outside of the event's main security cordon. The hotel had multiple exits that spilled out in every direction, enough that any watcher could be off and away before the echo of a bomb blast had faded. That, and the fact that the comings and goings of the press corps would provide adequate cover to anyone doing anything untoward, made it an ideal choice. The only thing he couldn't figure was exactly how the devices were going to be detonated. He kept thinking back to the screen on the makeshift cellular trigger. One missed call. As the lift rose, Mark felt around inside his backpack and found the dead detonator. He turned it over in his fingers, scowling at it. Any cellular device could be used to send a signal to it, and with the right setup, it could be pinged through any number of networks, not just mobile or landline, but by satellite phone or voice over internet protocols. If he could not see through this puzzle, the death toll would be catastrophic, and it would be his fault. A bell rang, and the freight elevator deposited him on the penthouse level. One hand around the butt of the pistol buried in his jacket, Mark set off down the service corridor. It took a physical effort not to steal another glance at his watch. For the duration of the president's rally, a stretch of Independence Avenue had been repurposed as a parking and disembarkation area alongside the Department of Agriculture building. Barriers erected to guide the buses arriving and departing funneled each new group of students through metal detectors before allowing them onto the mall and into the gathering throng. Teep pulled into an offloading area directed to a halt by a police officer who communicated through shrill blasts on a silver whistle between her lips. Jadid stood up, nervous energy fluttering through him, and cast a look over the faces of his charges. "Remember," he began, "do not speak if you are spoken to. Do not react. You are deaf and dumb. If you are challenged, show them your identity card and move on." They nodded back, and Jadid paused to slip on a pair of spectacles before adjusting the tie and shirt he was now wearing. He took a light jacket and folded it over his arm. His new attire had been carefully selected to give the impression of a scholarly, unimposing man, and he felt lost in the constricting clothes. He gave Teep a meaningful look. "Remain here." "Cops ain't gonna let me stay long," he replied. "I will return soon. In the meantime, do nothing to draw attention to yourself." "Sure," Teep looked away. "Whatever you say." Jadid beckoned the youths, and they rose as one, following him down the steps and off the bus in an orderly line. Some of them could not help but stare, fascinated by their first close-up view of the streets of an American city. The group was drawn into a queue, and Jadid feigned a smile as a portly woman in a uniform shirt snatched the pass he offered and peered at it. Nearby, he saw more police officers in full deployment gear, and on the far side of the barriers, there were patrols moving back and forth through the crowds. Some had dogs, their sensitive snouts looking for anything hazardous. The security situation was exactly as the Combine had said it would be.
"Wayne County School for the Deaf," said the woman.
She gave the youths a sour glance, her face pinching.
"No disrespect, mister, but if your kids can't hear, how are they going to follow the speeches?"
Jadid showed a wide, fixed grin.
"They can read lips, ma'am," he told her.
Raised voices distracted the woman, and she held on to Jadid's pass rather than hand it back. He turned to see what she was looking at and stiffened. Jadid saw a face he recognized. An angry man with thinning brown hair was in the process of arguing with a pair of police officers, standing at the head of a group of sullen-looking teenagers. The lawmen had a fan of identity passes in their hands, and they presented humorless expressions behind the mirrored lenses of wraparound sunglasses. Jadid knew the angry man's face. He had seen it and those of the students on the passes he had stolen from the safe of an airport motel room only a day earlier. The teacher from Los Angeles was losing his patience trying to explain that of course his passes were in order. The woman gave an arch sniff and dropped Jadid's pass back into his hand.
"Move along,"
she said, dismissing him, so that she might take a closer interest in what was about to happen to the party from L.A.
"And have a nice day."
Mark moved through the facade behind the hotel's well-kept corridors.
Here the carpet was threadbare, and the decor was purely functional. The residents of the Willard never laid eyes on these areas, the service passages that threaded through the building like veins through a body. He spotted a doorway leading to roof access. Mark took a step toward it and hesitated, catching the faint sound of radio static at the edge of his hearing. There was a laundry cart off to one side, as if it had been discarded in the shadows. A sense of wrongness chimed in Mark's thoughts. It seemed out of place, and he went to it, reaching out a hand to pull back the cloth draped over the top of the wheeled basket. In the cart was the body of a man wearing a police uniform, and he was very dead. Mark stiffened, seeing a red lesion on the policeman's throat, livid like an insect bite. A fatal injection? Glancing around, he saw no blood, no signs of struggle. This had been a clean kill, designed to draw no attention. The dead man's gun was still in his holster, along with the service radio clipped to his jacket. The weak sound was coming from the handheld, and Mark leaned closer to listen, holding his breath.
"Command, Station 6. How copy?"
said a woman. It was a status check, a regular call to an isolated officer on watch to monitor for any security breaches.
"6,"
came another voice. "All clear." A pulse of static garbled the transmission, and the woman spoke again.
"Please repeat."
"6. All clear."
Mark caught the timbre of the reply. It was identical to the first response. The same pause, the same intonation.
"Command confirms. Over."
He reached down to shift the body and saw the name Dwyer on the dead policeman's ID tab. Drawing his pistol, Mark made for the stairs. He climbed up and put his arm to a pushbar door, shouldering it open. Light flooded over him as he emerged onto the roof of the Willard. He came out near the edge of the building, facing Pershing Park and the city beyond. Up here, an orchard of satellite antenna had been set up to channel the feeds of the news trucks down on the street. Behind him, Mark heard movement and turned sharply, keeping his Glock tucked out of sight behind his back. He saw another figure in the blue of a DC cop's uniform coming toward him, drawn by the creak of the door. The man had a craggy face beneath the peaked policeman's cap and a curious expression. It took a fraction of a second for Mark to understand what he was seeing. It was recognition. He heard the click of a hammer being cocked.
"Fuck me," said the policeman,
in an accent that was harsh and grating and very definitely not American.
"Is that you?"
Morning light flashed off a gun barrel as it aimed Mark's way and he shrank back.
"Drop the weapon!"
The policeman's Sig Sauer pistol had a non-regulation silencer attached to the muzzle. One final confirmation for Mark that he had made a grave miscalculation. Cursing inwardly, he released the grip on the Glock and let it dangle on his trigger finger.
"You killed Officer Dwyer."
"Who?"
The other man advanced, keeping the gun on him. He had to be one of Grunwald's mercenaries. "The cop in the laundry car." He shrugged, as if the man's murder was meaningless.
"I'll guess." "Toss the gun," snarled the killer.
As Mark let the pistol fall to the ground and kicked it away, an incredulous sneer broke out on his face.
"How the hell are you still alive?"
he said, with an air of mild amazement.
"You are fucking lucky. That's what you are."
He angled his head, studying him.
"Don't remember me, do you? On the yacht, we had a little back and forth, yeah?"
He gestured with the pistol. "Novakovich, you were on the kill team."
"I've done in a lot of folks," admitted the mercenary. "Doesn't seem to take with you, though. How'd you bring down that drone, eh?"
"You saw that." He got a shrug in return.
"It doesn't matter. You had a good run, but you're out now, son."
The other man pointed with the silencer in the direction of the rear of the building.
"Start walking."
"You're going to push me off the roof," Mark said, trying to stall. "Not smart." The mercenary laughed unkindly.
"Oh, no. You're too good to be true. I've got someone you've got to meet before I shoot you dead."
Jadid strolled us casually to one of the plastic archways that were the last gate between the outside world and the inner cordon of the rally. To most people passing through them,
the arches would have seemed little different to the metal detectors that scanned the passages into any modern airport. But it was Jadid's business to recognize such devices for what they were, to know their capabilities and sensitivities. These arches concealed full body scanners that swept those who stepped through them with an extremely high-frequency radio signal, capable of penetrating layers of clothing. Anyone concealing a weapon on their person would immediately be identified. The arches represented the last barrier between success and failure. Jadid glanced back at the youths following him and beckoned the teenager in front to come forward. Adad gave him a brief, questioning look but said nothing. "Go on," he told him. Adad emptied his pockets into a tray and walked slowly through the arch. There was a chime, and Jadid craned his neck to catch a glimpse of the screen through which another police officer monitored those entering the rally. He saw a ghost image of Adad, rendered like a vague chalk sketch on dark paper. Nothing of the weapon he carried within his flesh showed on the display, only the lines of his body beneath the clothes he wore. The officer tending the arch waved at Jadid, and he bobbed his head, smiling again. He hid his relief as he passed through without sounding any alerts. One by one, each of the youths followed in Adad's footsteps, and each time the scanning machine saw nothing. A sense of calm settled on Jadid as he led them deeper into the crowds. "We have done it. The enemy looked and did not see." "This way," he told them. Jadid slipped his smartphone from his pocket as he walked and saw that the data and cellular indicators were dark. No signal could reach them within the cordon. He glanced around, taking in the crowds. Somewhere nearby, a localized jamming device was blanketing the area as part of the security precautions, a measure designed to prevent the use of cell phones to trigger remote detonated devices. Jadid smiled thinly, thinking of the confusion that would strike the Americans when they realized their defenses had been circumvented. He beckoned the others.
"Stay with me," said Jadid, "and keep away from the men with the dogs."
They moved deeper into the throng, pushing their way toward the distant stage. Ahead of them, a dozen tall flagpoles were spread in a semicircle, and from each fluttered the stars and stripes. Jadid's smile widened as he imagined each one of them falling to the earth, wreathed in flames. There was a second bogus policeman on the Willards' roof. He had a pair of powerful binoculars raised to his face, peering out over the buildings to the southeast. The South African mercenary shoved Mark toward the other man with a hard push in the small of the back.
"Hey," snarled the merc. "Tommy, or whatever you're damn well called, look here. I brought you a present. Not as dead as you'd like, eh?"
"What are you on about?"
growled the other man, in a harsh London accent that made Mark's blood turn to ice.
"Supposed to stay at your fucking post, you tosser."
The second man put down the binoculars and turned to see what was important enough to interrupt him. When he met Mark Dane's gaze, there was the smallest flash of shock, quickly smothered by the spread of a predatory smile. Mark was looking at a dead man, someone who had been consumed in fire on a French dockside, lost along with Sam Green and the rest of his squad in the explosion that destroyed the Palomino. Now he heard his heartbeat thundering in his ears. Mark felt a sudden sense of dislocation, as if the roof beneath his feet had unfolded and dropped him into freefall. He tried to say the name, but his throat felt like it was filled with cinders.
"You," began the other man, with loathing in his words. "You never learn, do you? Couldn't just die and be done with it. Shit."
"You're alive," Mark blurted it out, finally finding his voice.
"Nash."
"Surprise,"
he said with the same arrogant sneer Mark had seen a dozen times before. 26. His hard-edged face was split by a scornful grin that seemed to eclipse everything around Mark.
"What's the matter?"
Ian Nash chugged with mocking laughter.
"You look like you've seen a ghost."
"He's dead. She's dead. They are all dead." The harsh truth of Nomad Team's murder was the one thing he knew was undeniable among all the shifting sands of loyalty, distrust, and lies. It was the single truth he had never questioned, but now he saw this man standing in front of him, and it all began to crumble. "How?" he managed, unable to frame all the questions suddenly shouting at him for answers.
"Nash," said the South African. "So not Tommy, then?"
"Ian Nash is dead," said the other man. "Except he ain't."
He stepped down onto the roof proper and looked Mark up and down, enjoying the moment.
"Come on then, Dane. You always thought you were so fucking smart."
He prodded Mark in the shoulder.
"Can you figure it out, you clever little sod?"
Mark's mind reeled back to that night in France, forcing himself to remember what he had witnessed from Op Team Van. The feeds from the assault team, the night vision footage from his micro drone.
"I saw you die,"
he blurted out the words, feeling giddy and sick inside.
"Did you?"
Nash sniffed.
"I tell you what,
let me lay it out for you, just so I can see the look on your sorry face." He glanced at the other man.
"I mean, after all the trouble he's been, I deserve to get something out of this, don't I? A little entertainment."
He spread his hands.
"What did you see? Think about it. What did you really see with your little toy box?"
Nash turned his head and spat, advancing. The other mercenary was at Mark's back, and he felt the muzzle of the silent SIG push against his shoulder blades, cutting off any avenue of escape.
"You got off the Palomino before the explosion."
"Bra fucking vo," Nash clapped, slow and exaggerated. "That's your problem, Dane. See, you lot think you got sight of the whole world through your computers and your drones and your bloody cameras."
His mocking snarl hardened, becoming fiercer, stronger.
"I got sick of you and the rest. You never get it. You don't see how it is out in the grind. You don't get shot at or pissed on or screwed over day in, day out."
Nash's hands contracted into fists.
"The real shit every poor bastard Tommy has to deal with."
He pointed two fingers toward his narrowed eyes, looming over the other man.
"You don't see that from some nice soft chair. You don't want to get any of it on you."
In that moment, Mark's fear faded away, and in its place rose a wellspring of anger, a burning resentment at the callous murder of his teammates, at Sam Green's cruel death, at all of it.
"Fuck you, Nash," he spat. "Fuck you. We were your team, and you led us to the slaughter."
"Not everyone," he shot back, grinning.
"You survived. I mean, who thought that would happen? You, last man standing."
He gave a derisive snort.
"Wouldn't sit down and die, would you? Like a stone in my shoe, all the way here."
Ricks, Bell, Marshall.
Their names fell from him in a litany.
Leon and Owen.
And Sam. You betrayed them. Why?
Mark shouted, putting all the fury and sorrow in him into one word.
What was worth that?
Never was a team player.
Nash gave a low chuckle. See, I like money. I like guns. And I like blowing things up for a living. But six is slower than a shit at the North Pole, and I'll get bored easy.
The Combine recruited you, yeah?
Offered the other merc.
I went to them.
Nash shook his head. They're already in British intelligence, deep. They snapped me up, mate. Saw my skills, knew I was hungry and fed up, but they didn't like the op teams. Nah, they don't like things they can't manage, you get me? He glared at Mark. Ricks, he had a big mouth, didn't he? Was looking at stuff he shouldn't have. Figured out that there was a mole at the cross. He was going to go right to the big man, and he roped in Sam and me to help him.
Idiot.
Nash hesitated.
Well, you know how that ended up. The rest was just collateral damage.
Mark saw the pieces falling into place. With Nash thought dead, along with the rest of Nomad, he was free to drop off the radar and become a direct agent for the Combine's interests.
You wanted to wipe us out.
His lips thinned. But it was a balls up.
You missed one.
Mark jerked a thumb in his own direction. Nash's grin cooled.
I admit, that did not make me happy. Anyone else, I might have been impressed. But you?
got out by dumb fucking luck. He leaned in. Tell me something. Did you cry about her when you were on the run? Did you shed a tear for that bitch? Mark started forward, the impulse to strike Nash coming from out of nowhere, but he barely got a step before the other mercenary struck him across the back of the neck. He staggered and gasped through the pain. Let me tell you something, Nash went on, as if nothing had happened. Sam, you weren't the first place she went for her fun. You were a long way down that list. Is that why you killed her? Mark retorted. He knew that Sam Green had been with other men before him, but it had never occurred to him to look inside Nomad. Suddenly, all the veiled slights Nash had ever directed at him took on a new focus. Did she have enough of your macho bullshit and cut you loose? Something flared in Nash's eyes, and Mark was certain he had struck a nerve. For a moment, he thought that the turncoat agent was going to take him on, but instead he pointed a finger at Mark's face, and the cold sneer returned. Women, eh? Who knows how they think? I don't know what she ever saw in you. You're a fucking washout. You've never had the stones to do the job. Being a clever boy don't get you far, pal. You ain't got the fucking instinct in you. He looked away. I got a call. Told me you were probably heading to DC. You were either going to show up here or get yourself caught in all the shitstorm that's coming. Nash glanced at his watch. In the next 30 minutes. What? Mark caught on Nash's words. Who called you? The other one, said the Afrikaner mercenary, at MI6. Like I said, in deep. Wasn't just me who was smart enough to see the writing on the wall, Nash explained. London's been tracking you, and what Six knows, so do we. He chuckled again. If you'd been good at this, you might have been able to get the drop on me, but nah, you're too fucking weak to pull a trigger. Mark met Nash's gaze. You'll be surprised at what I'm capable of.
Oh?
Nash gave a slow nod and gestured at the air. All this, then? That's been the making of you, has it? Toughened you up? He came closer. Made a man of you? His fist came up in a fast right cross, and Mark instinctively flinched back. The blow never landed, stopping short, as Nash let his hand drop and laughed at his reaction. Ellis, he said, glancing at the other man. Make use of this prick. Waste him and stick him with that dead copper. Make it look like he did it. Give the Yanks the runaround. What about you?
Time to book, Nash replied.
If our soul here found us, more trouble's coming.
The hotel is full of feds, Mark snapped, seizing on the other man's words.
Yeah, sure, Nash sniffed, unimpressed. Get him out of my sight, and for fuck's sake, make sure he's dead this time.
The South African mercenary grabbed a handful of Mark's shoulder strap and dragged him up by his backpack, cracking him a second time across the neck with his gun.
Walk on, he grated, pushing him away toward the rooftop access.
The crowd was in a buoyant mood, and music was playing across the mall, piped in through speaker stacks arranged before the stage. On video screens as big as the side of a house, a youth group from Seattle were playing a spirited take on some old jazz number and people were clapping. The main event was close at hand, the introduction of the President of the United States and the speech that would kick off a week of education-related rallies and political events here in the nation's capital. Lucy's federal badge had got her into the rally, but she knew that security would have already run her details, that they would be scrambling people right now to surround her and bring her in. She saw the Michigan school bus out on the street. They were here. Pushing aside everything else crowding her mind, she made herself think like a terrorist, scanning the crowds and seeing only targets to be destroyed. Where would I go? She started moving again, plotting out optimal points of attack, and immediately one location leapt out at her. Close to the main stage, beyond a set of tall flagpoles, good sight lines, heavy civilian concentration, massive potential for casualties. As she approached, a figure caught Lucy's eye, a man in a conservative suit jacket, his face half hidden behind thick rimmed eyeglasses. His movement drew her because he had changed direction in the middle of his stride, pivoting away from a police dog handler. The man was carefully avoiding the gaze of the cop, and in the process, he allowed her to get a good look at him instead. She knew him. A few hours earlier, aboard Solomon's jet as it crossed the Atlantic, Lucy had spent the time, when she couldn't sleep, poring over files that Delancourt had dredged up from Rubicon's archives. This man's face had been among them, part of a list of known associates of the terrorist Omar Khadr. Jadid Amra, one of al-Saif's active soldiers, ex-military like his commander, a zealot and ruthless with it. Amra had made a good attempt to fox any facial recognition software that might be sifting security camera feeds, the heavy glasses breaking up his profile just enough to confuse a machine, but not enough to keep a human eye from making the connection. She glanced around. If he was here, then so were the carriers. Lucy reached for her smartphone, then realized that it would be useless inside the no-signal cell jamming zone. Amara drifted away, melting into the crowd, and she lost sight of him. Lucy cursed and pushed her way through another knot of teenagers, ignoring their complaints as she made a beeline for the flags. Behind her, she heard a dog barking, but the noise was lost as the jazz players launched in to the raucous up-tempo finale of their set. She kept pushing on, scanning the faces in the crowd. A jolt of despair clutched at her chest, and Lucy felt the first stirrings of actual panic. What if she was standing right here, still looking for him, when it happened? A string of violent detonations, bodies bursting open into fireballs, hundreds caught in the inferno, many more scarred for life. Horrible images of carnage clouded her thoughts, and it took a physical effort for her to shake them off. She chided herself. "Don't dwell, girl," she thought. "That's not how they trained you." Lucy pushed the momentary lapse to the back of her mind, and in that second, she saw her target. He was no more than 200 meters distant from her, moving toward the far end of the stage. There were three youths walking close by, following in his footsteps, and her breath caught in her throat as she realized who and what they had to be. That meant the others al-Saif had brought to Washington were already here, already in place. Lucy moved toward Amara, never taking her eyes off him. Then a strong hand closed around her wrist and she spun, trying and failing to disengage. A woman and a man were crowding in on her, both of them in the basic black suits that were the uniform of the United States Secret Service. "Ma'am, can you come with us, please?" The female agent holding her had a dark and unreadable complexion. Lucy glimpsed the tip of a stun prod in her other hand, concealed up the sleeve of her jacket. "Don't make a scene," said the second agent, his eyes lost behind a pair of black sunglasses. "Listen to me," Lucy began, keeping her stance neutral, to show she wasn't a threat. "There's a high-value terrorist target on site right here." She turned to point to where Amra had been standing, but her heart sank as she realized he had vanished once again. "He's here," she insisted. "If you just..." "I'll put you down if you make me." The woman was deadly serious. "We know who you are, Keyes. How this goes next is up to you." Lucy's lip curled. "You think I would just waltz in here and let you see me unless I wanted to? There's a threat."
"And we're looking at it," said the other agent. "Lucille Keyes, you're under arrest. Now walk, because we won't ask again."
"Shit,"
she hesitated. If push came to shove, Lucy believed she had a 50-50 chance of taking down these two. But if she did, it would be right here in broad daylight with hundreds of onlookers and reinforcements would be on her in moments, not to mention what might happen if Amara was spooked. The smart choice was to surrender at least for the moment, and then try to get these people to listen to her, but time was against her. "Okay, I'm not resisting, but I need to talk to the agent in charge, and in the next 10 minutes. "Why?" demanded the other woman. "Because if you wait, we may not be around to have a conversation." Each footstep was marking off the distance to that last bullet. Mark could sense it waiting for him, a burning shot that would end him on this windswept rooftop thousands of miles from home. The injustice of it raged inside him. After coming so far,
After putting a face to the pain and the anger that had driven him, Mark could not allow it to end like this. He vowed there would be no more casualties today from Al-Saif's vindictive war and the Combine's ruthless power games. I won't let it happen. He walked ahead of Ellis, slouched and feigning defeat with every pace. Given all he had been through, it wasn't hard to fake it. In front of Mark, laid across the roof, was another cable threading toward a temporary cell-band tower erected by a tech crew from TV5 Mond. Take the chance, he told himself. Got nothing else to lose. At the last second, Mark kicked at the cable with his heel, and the impact made it twitch across the ground, sidewinding like a disturbed snake. He risked that Ellis's eye would be drawn to the motion, a reflex action that would give Mark a fraction of a second to throw himself into the shadow of a ventilator cover. He dove forward, but Ellis was quicker than he expected, and the mercenary's gun coughed twice. Two rounds from the Sig Sauer hit him between the shoulders, twin punches that knocked him down. Neither shot penetrated through the day pack hanging on his back, the thick nylon and the case of his battle-worn laptop absorbing the brunt of the force. He hit the ground and rolled, hearing Ellis curse him and come running. The mercenary decided not to play the game and follow him around the low vent. Instead, Ellis put one foot on the lip of the obstruction and came straight up over it with a grunt of effort, panning with a silenced gun, aiming where he thought Mark would have landed. His target wasn't there, only the damaged backpack. Then a black blur flicked up from the roof, and Ellis was struck in the chest by a length of communications cable. Mark emerged from behind the antenna, both hands gripping the line. He pulled hard on it, making it crack like a whip. There was enough play in the cable to use it as a makeshift weapon, knocking the mercenary from his ill-chosen perch. Ellis went down hard and lost his gun as he hit the gravel on the roofing. The Sig Sauer bounced against the lintel and landed close to the edge. Mark lunged at the gun as Ellis scrambled to come at him, the bigger man's muscular hands snatching at air as he failed to grab the hem of his jacket. Mark's fingers scraped the roof and pawed at the pistol. He had it in his hand as Ellis's vice-like grip closed around his ankle. The mercenary pulled hard, dragging Mark toward him, raising his fist to strike him in the gut. Mark pulled the trigger again and again, blind firing and letting the recoil of the weapon bring it up and across. Hot brass cartridges clattered back at him, bouncing off his face and his chest. All but one shot missed. The round caught Ellis in the mouth and emerged through the back of his head, blowing out a wet streamer of blood, meat, and tooth fragments. The mercenary managed a strangled, gurgling moan and stumbled. His ankle caught the inner edge of the lintel, and Ellis toppled over. Mark bolted to his feet, but he was too late to arrest the other man's dive. He got to the edge just as the mercenary's body landed on a taxi parked below, cratering the hood and smashing the windshield. The terrified driver spilled out onto the sidewalk and someone screamed. Mark shrank back as all eyes on the street turned to stare upward. He scrambled away. There had to be other observers on rooftops nearby, real cops, he guessed, and while they might have missed the chug of silenced gunfire among the noise of traffic and tourists, they wouldn't ignore screams for long. His Glock was still lying near the access door where he had dropped it, and Mark snatched at the gun. Gathering it up with his backpack, he sagged and blew out a breath. Inside the bag, his laptop was marred with two massive impact dents, and it gave a sickly rattle when he shook it. He sighed and zipped the pack closed. The next 30 minutes. Mark stole a look at his watch, checked the remaining ammunition in the silenced SIG's magazine, and doubled back the way he had come. Nash had the smartphone to his ear, scowling at the voice on the other end of the line. Listen, he snapped. Don't get your fucking knickers in a twist. I'm dealing with your mistakes. You just do your part and... He broke off as he heard a crash of breaking glass and the distant noise of a woman's scream. I'll call you back, Nash added and ended the conversation. Reaching inside his jacket for his pistol, his gun cleared its holster just as the first shot chopped at the ground near his feet. Nash dove behind a skylight. He hadn't heard the report of a firearm, which meant a silenced weapon.
which means that dozy prick Ellis is dead, and Dane has his gun. He spat in annoyance and rose up, aiming by instinct in the direction the shot had come from. He saw his former teammate running between two air conditioning units and fired at him, rounds sparking off the metal housings. Dane fired back blindly, trying to force Nash to keep his head down, but the ex-soldier had walked through far more intense fields of fire and never flinched. Instead, he jumped to his feet and broke into a sprint. Mark felt the Sig Sauer go dead in his hand as he slid down behind the aircon unit. The pistol's breech was jammed. Mark was firing so fast that an empty brass cartridge had jammed in the ejector port. He cursed and worked the slide, flicking the casing away. The silent Sig was almost empty, and even though Mark still had the other gun in his backpack, both weapons used different bullets and couldn't share the suppressor. If he went to the 9mm semi-automatic, firing a shot in the open would be like sending up a distress flare. Police snipers and aerial units would be on him in moments. But then the question became moot, as Ian Nash hove into view at full tilt. Mark brought up the Sig, but his hesitation had cost him vital seconds, and Nash was right there, swinging a vicious haymaker that knocked him into the aircon unit with an echoing clang. Mark tasted copper in his mouth, and his skull rang with the impact. "I don't believe you," Nash was saying, almost incredulous. "You've got to have something wrong in your head. When are you going to learn to run away?" He followed the snarling words with another 1-2 punch that Mark attempted to block. He lost the silenced pistol and staggered back as Nash continued to advance. The other man holstered his weapon. "You should have run in France. You had the luck in London. Instead, you come back for more. But you get no more chances, shithead." He cracked his knuckles and shook out his hands. "I reckon I'll enjoy this." Mark pushed off and landed two lightning blows on the right side of Nash's face, pounding as hard as he could to strike at the bigger man's jaw. Nash's head rocked under each blow as it landed, but he seemed to feel nothing. The ex-soldier's eyes widened and he lunged forward, grabbing the daypack straps across Mark's chest. With a growl of effort, he wrenched Mark off his feet and slammed him hard against the air conditioner again. Without letting go, Nash reversed his move and flung Mark back the other way, dashing him to the rooftop. Mark hit hard and tumbled, seeing stars. He tried to scramble back, tried to get his footing, but Nash came in like a striker making a free kick and planted a heavy tactical boot in his ribs. Fire blazed across Mark's chest as the blow landed, and all the air in his lungs was expelled in a coughing gasp. "Get up!" Nash's voice seemed distant and woolly. "Don't puss out on me." The bigger man dragged him up from the ground and dropped another punch to knock him down again. Mark weathered the blow and lashed out, landing a hit in the side of Nash's knee, earning a grunt of pain. In return, Nash hauled him up and shoved Mark into the door of a machine room in the middle of the hotel rooftop. The door buckled under the weight of him, and Mark stumbled inside, blinking at the dimness within. He tried to put distance between him and Nash, but the other man was still coming. Ian Nash had trained with the Special Air Service. He had been a full-time tactical field officer for MI6. He was in a different league to Mark Dane, who was all whipcord and adrenaline. Nash was the bulldog to Mark's greyhound, conditioned for stamina and dishing out violence as well as absorbing it. "You can't beat him head-on," Mark told himself. The machine room was a windowless concrete space above the four elevators that served the Willard Hotel's residential floors. Positioned over each shaft was a powerful electric motor with a spinning wheel that guided steel cables down through a slot in the floor to the mechanism on the top of each lift car. Banks of switching gear and a maintenance bench were the room's only other furnishings, harsh light spilling across the chamber from a single fluorescent tube overhead. Nash followed him in, booting the door shut as he pulled at the tab on the belt that was part of his police officer disguise. "I got a jet," he said to the air. "Work to do. But I can't pass this up, can I?" He let the belt, gun, holster, and all drop to the floor, then shrugged off his jacket. "Lost count of the number of times I thought about knocking seven shades of shit out of you." He rolled his shoulders, savouring the moment. "Feelings mutual," Mark panted, getting unsteadily to his feet. "Come on, then. You're not on the terraces now, you fucking thug." Nash
raised his hands into a boxer's stance. "You don't know me," he retorted. "You've never been a soldier. You sat in a Ponzi helicopter. You think you can talk to me like you stood a post? Piss off." "You're right, Nash," Mark shrugged, backing away toward the motor gear. "I'm not like you. You're just a yob who joined up because he wanted a way to hurt people." His temper rose, and he jabbed a finger at the other man. "Don't come out with that honour of the regiment bollocks to me. You don't give a damn about Queen and Country. You're a gutless traitor." "Oh, you got my number." Nash pulled a mock sad face. "I'm cut to the quick, me." His expression twisted into a savage snarl. "They let me down first. Salute and do the Crown's dirty work for what? A pittance? A crap pension and an ungrateful country run by posh wankers and asylum seekers?" He shook his head. "Fuck that noise. I shed my blood. I want my cut." "And the Combine will give it to you. Off the back of killing your own squad. Murdering hundreds of innocent people." "Oh," Nash snorted coldly. "You think I care about them? Or those civvies out there?" He jerked his thumb in the direction of the National Mall. "You think anyone gives a toss about Kadir's crusade or a bunch of whining Yanks? All a means to an end. If it don't happen here today, it'll happen tomorrow somewhere else." He saw the question in Mark's eyes and grinned unpleasantly. "Yeah, you're getting it now, are you? The Combine's been at this shit for years. They were selling bullets to both sides in the First World War. Now they're working up trouble where and when they want it and coining it in. Anyone on the outside of that is a fucking chump." "They'll be stopped." "What? By you?" Nash laughed. "And whose army?" Words failed him, and Mark went for Nash, feinting to the right and then going low to throw out a short, stabbing strike to his stomach. The ex-soldier grunted in pain and grabbed at Mark, backhanding him with a glancing blow that lit sparks behind his eyes. Off balance, Mark couldn't stop Nash from shoving him down onto one of the elevator gears. He collided with the main motor, barely arresting his fall before his face struck the spinning edge of the gear wheel. But Nash had followed him down, and he pressed his full weight into Mark's back. Mark's hand slipped on the motor casing, the muscles in his arms bunching as he put all his effort into holding back. The stale odor of grease filled his nostrils as the wheel flashed past inches from his face. Nash's thick fingers gripped the back of Mark's head and pushed him inexorably toward the metal gears. If the rotating rim met his flesh, it would cut into him like a blunted buzzsaw. He could hear the clatter and rattle of the elevators beneath him, and for long seconds the two of them were locked in place, each resisting the other. But Mark's muscles were already trembling with effort, while all Nash had to do was keep up the relentless pressure. The bigger man was leaning in on him, marshalling all the force he could muster. Then, with a thudding sound, the elevator directly below reached the lobby level and stopped. The spinning gear wheel clanked to a halt, and Mark felt the tiniest relaxing of Nash's hand as the other man reacted. It was the only opening he would get. With all his remaining strength, Mark threw back his shoulders and his head. The top of his skull slammed into Nash's face, and Mark felt the crunch of cartilage a split second before it was drowned out by the wave of brutal pain that swept through him. Nash let out a guttural animal noise, reeling back. He blinked and dragged a hand over his nose and mouth, his palm coming away wet with blood. Mark rolled toward the workbench, across the machine room. He snatched at the first thing that looked like a weapon, a weighty, adjustable spanner, and came back toward Nash, swinging it in a wide arc. The other man backed off and grinned, showing bloody teeth. Nash beckoned Mark with both hands.
"Let's have you then,"
he grunted, pausing to cough out a glob of bloody spittle. "I'll shove that down your throat, prick." Mark raised the tool like a club, but instead of advancing to attack, he struck out at the fluorescent lighting tube hanging from the machine room's ceiling. He turned his face away as the spanner shattered the tube and plunged the confined space into semi-darkness with a burst of electricity. "I will fucking gut you," Nash bellowed, enraged and near flash-blinded. He lurched toward the door, where he had dumped his jacket and belt, groping for the pistol he had discarded there. He was tired of playing this game,
and Nash wanted nothing more than to end Mark Dane's life as quickly and painfully as possible. The only light in the room was now coming up in weak shafts through the cable guides. He heard footsteps scuffling across the concrete flooring, glimpsed a shadow caught in the half-light. Nash would kill Dane here and leave the smartphone on the body, make it look like he'd been in on the attack all along and left for dead by his Al-Saif co-conspirators. He smiled in the dark as his fingers touched the metal cylinder of a big police-issue maglite torch. It wasn't the gun, but it would do. Nash liked the way this story was shaping up. He grabbed the flashlight and spun around, stabbing the button to drench the room in illumination.
"Surprise, you fuckwit!"
The space in front of him was empty. Then, from the shadows by his side, a hard nub of metal jabbed him in the temple. From the corner of his eye, he saw the blurry shape of a silencer pressed to his head. Nash was going to say something. Mark saw it in the parting of his lips, heard the swift, indrawn breath. But he had already committed to the act. Whatever thought was forming in the other man's mind never completed the journey. Mark's finger tightened on the Sig Sauer's trigger, and the gun bucked in his hand. Nash jerked back as if he'd been hit in the head by a hammer. Dark blood and brain matter glittered in the edge glow from the flashlight as it sprayed up the wall. He collapsed into the corner of the machine room, his body giving a final shuddering twitch before it became still. Mark held the gun tightly. In the darkness, he had found Nash's pistol in the folds of his jacket, and he gambled that the ex-soldier was cocky enough to carry it with the safety off and a round already chambered. Aggressive and predictable to the last, Nash had not let him down. It didn't seem like enough. A man Mark had thought was dead, seemingly resurrected just to spite him, and now dead again by his hand, this time for certain. It wasn't enough that he had died here, out of sight of the world, his crimes still hidden. Mark wanted Nash to be alive so he could punish him, berate him, kill him again. He wanted to shoot him in the belly, let him lie there and bleed out slowly and painfully.
"I should have known this was coming. I knew you were a bastard from the first day I saw you," he told the corpse, tired and furious all at once. "You murdered Sam, and all you've done is die for it."
Mark aimed the gun and wavered on the edge of unloading the rest of the magazine into the dead man out of sheer hate for him. Instead, he got to his feet, groaning as all the bruising and contusions across his body made themselves known. Mark gathered up the police jacket, searching the pockets for more ammunition, for anything that could be useful. The black slab of a smartphone tumbled out and clattered across the floor. Mark left the stairwell on the ninth floor, the door crashing open with a bang that echoed down the corridor. A businessman, who had slept late and was still in his hotel-issued dressing gown, almost dropped the breakfast tray he was depositing outside his room as Mark charged past.
"Hey, buddy," he called. "Where's the fire?"
"I need this," Mark told him, snatching up the ice bucket on the tray, handing back the empty wine bottle it contained. Mark dumped the meltwater through the overflow grill of a nearby ice machine and quickly refilled it with fresh cubes. Without pausing, he stuffed the black cell phone he'd found in Nash's jacket into the ice. The man laughed.
"That's going to void your warranty."
Mark didn't reply, carrying the bucket back to the stairwell. He attached a cable to a port on the bottom of the phone, as frost formed on the device's glassy screen. Mark had dumped Nash's gun, the fake police jacket, and the contents of his battered day pack on the stairwell's narrow metal landing, and left his wounded laptop to power up. While it was heavily ruggedized, the portable computer wasn't invulnerable, and Mark glared at the screen, where it had fractured from bullet damage. Much of the display was marred with black voids, as if someone had spilt ink over a sheet of paper, but a fraction of the screen still functioned, and by some miracle the machine had booted. He dropped to his haunches and tapped the keyboard experimentally. It took 3 tries to get a USB socket working, and he double-clicked a password hijacker program as the laptop connected to the device down the cable. Rapidly chilling the smartphone and then hitting it with the code breaker could make the device's recent memory accessible and make it possible for Mark to sift out the key code Nash had used to lock the phone. The memory chips inside the device would retain the patterns of the code for a short period, and cooling it stopped that data from decaying too fast. In a few seconds, the hijacker was spooling out a page of barely readable information on the phone's settings, and among it was the vital 6 digits. Mark tipped out the bucket and tapped in the numbers, the ice-cold metal of the phone burning his fingers. He flicked through the menu screens. A single application was running, and he tapped it open. There was a series of countdown timers arranged in a column, each of them on a steady decrease towards zero, each one running a few tenths of a second slower than the one above it. The top timer clocked over to 14 minutes and falling as he watched. 14 minutes from now would be just after the top of the hour, when the president would be on stage making his speech. What he held in his hand was a trigger for Al-Saif's atrocity. Nash had doubtless kept access to the Qadir's weapons for himself, in case the Combine had decided to change the scope of the plan. Mark sat down hard on the metal stairs, and very carefully he drew his finger over a series of tabs next to the first timer. Arm. Safe. Zero. He didn't want to think about what zero would do, but safe was clear enough. He could stop this now with just a keystroke. What if it's a booby trap? He asked himself. Mark screwed his eyes shut and pressed the button, holding his breath, straining to listen for the sound of a detonation. But there was nothing. He opened his eyes again. The countdown was still going, and a pop-up message had appeared. Command not sent, it read. Unable to connect. He tried again and got the same result. It couldn't be an issue of distance, and Nash's phone was showing full bars and a strong network signal. Bollocks. His curse hung in the air, and he put down the device, glaring at it. I can't do this on my own, he told himself, reaching for his own smartphone. Rubicon's New York office answered on the second ring. I need Delancourt, he said. He's on the other line, said a woman's voice. This is Kara. I brought the car out to Jersey. He nodded, remembering the Chinese girl. Yeah, red jacket. He took a breath. Okay, we've got a situation. Are you all right? I'll manage, he lied, the pain in his ribs throbbing with slow insistence. Can you reach Lucy? Kara hesitated, and that was enough to tell him that something was amiss. We are monitoring DC police bands here, and it looks like someone matching her description has been taken into custody. I'm sorry, Dane, but you probably can't count on Lucy's help right now. Mark leaned away from the phone and made a snarling noise through his gritted teeth. Listen to me, he began, sucking in a deep breath. There were 2 observers in the Willard Hotel. There was no need to go into more detail than that right now. Details of Ian Nash's return from the dead and the end of him could wait. I got a phone from one of them, and it's running a remote timer for 7 separate devices. But the abort command isn't working. I don't know how we can locate the carriers, and I have no bloody idea what to do next. Dane! Henry Delacourt's voice cut in on the line. Can you run a feed from the stolen phone back to us? Our team here might be able to hack it remotely. In less than 14 minutes. He heard the French-Canadian swear softly under his breath. That's what I thought. This isn't a software problem, it's hardware. Something stopping the abort signal from getting through to the bomb carriers. The cell jammer, said Kara. That's it. What jammer? Where? She launched into a rapid-fire explanation without pausing for breath. The presidential motorcade has 2 mobile units that contain powerful short-range cellular and radio jamming systems. They can blanket up to 4 square city blocks with an umbrella of electronic countermeasures. That means no cell phone signals in or out. Mark nodded. He had seen similar setups during his time with British intelligence. Okay. They are usually deployed when the Secret Service is on a heightened state of alert, added Delancourt, and they are now, after the incident at the port of New Jersey. Right. Mark thought it through. The bombs are programmed and activated by the remote, but once they're inside the jammer radius, they can't get the abort call, so nothing can stop them from going off. Al-Saif are using the Secret Service's hardware against them.
His mouth was dry, and he licked his lips. So we need to kill this jammer then. How do we do that?
Short of blowing the thing up with a missile, you would have to actually pull the plug yourself,
Kara explained. Which requires access to the staging area, where the motorcade vehicles are parked, said Delancourt. And even if you could do it, the secondary mobile unit would automatically activate to cover the signal loss of the primary in a matter of seconds. An unpleasant certainty settled on Mark. A gallows walk, chill that spread through him like cold fire.
So that's what we're doing, yeah?
He heard himself say the words.
I'll send you an image of the vehicle so you know what to look for, said Kara, and he heard the clatter of her tapping at a keyboard. But, I mean, how are you going to get into the secure area?
Mark's eyes fell to the collection of items on the landing in front of him. The police jacket, the laptop, the gun, and the contents of the backpack. He reached for the press pass he had stolen on his way into the Willard and turned it over in his fingers.
I got an idea.
Lucy found herself in the back of an empty K-9 mobile unit. The interior of the van smelled like wet dog, and in short order she had taken to breathing through her mouth. They confiscated her gun, her phone, her watch, just about everything she had on her, short of a strip search, before binding her wrists with a zip tie and leaving her to wait. Still, Lucy's sense of time was good, and she estimated that they were still in the green, still in with a chance of stopping the attack. The problem was, with each minute she sat here, that margin grew thinner. Lucy began a count to 10. At 8, she was going to start kicking at the doors and screaming. She reached 5, and the rear of the van opened. The two agents who had corralled her on the mall were there, along with an older man who had the granite, hard manner of a drill sergeant. He took off his sunglasses and gave her a measuring look.
Come to take me for a walk? Lucy asked. You bring a leash?
That depends on how you behave.
The old man, who was clearly in command here, glanced at his subordinates.
I'll handle this.
He climbed into the van with Lucy, closed the doors behind him, and sat down opposite her.
You got a problem, she told him.
Every day, he replied. I'm Special Agent Rowan. You want to tell me why you're really here, Keyes, and don't waste my time with any bullshit. We ran your jacket. We confirmed your identity.
Jadid Amara, a top lieutenant of the Al-Saif terror group. He's out there right now with his finger on the actual trigger.
She leaned toward him.
That clear enough for you, Special Agent Rowan?
Yeah, that's what you told my people.
He paused, running a hand through his thinning hair. Lucy guessed Rowan was in his early 50s, and by his manner, she pegged him as ex-military.
You served?
She asked, the question coming to her automatically. He answered by unbuttoning the cuff of his shirt and pulling it back a few inches. On the inside of his forearm was a simple tattoo in black ink, the silhouette of a dagger, and the Latin phrase, De oppresso liber.
To liberate the oppressed, she translated. So you were SF.
It wasn't a question. The dagger was part of the sigil of the U.S. Army's 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment, also known as Delta Force.
Bravo, Squadron, he told her. Before your time in the unit.
He rolled down the sleeve again.
I've heard of you, Lucille Keyes. I heard about what you did.
She shook her head. We don't have time for this. For the record, you really don't know why I ended up in the Miramar stockade. You just know what they told you.
Why show your face? Rowan asked her. I mean, you were trained better than that. You had to know we'd tag you.
Of course I knew, she shot back. You think I wanted to give up my nice life as a federal fugitive for shits and giggles?
You came to warn us about a terrorist attack.
Yes, goddammit.
Rowan cocked his head.
Or maybe you're unstable like your file says, and this is some kind of drama you're playing out.
Lucy hesitated on the edge of letting her ill temper slip, but instead she pulled it back. She found the calm, centered place that kept her level each time she was preparing to make a shot. She couldn't afford to miss here, either. What she said next would mean the difference between Rowan taking her seriously or locking her up and throwing away the key.
Do I look like I'm off balance? She asked, her voice firm. I'll lay this out for you.
When the president comes on stage, operatives of Al-Saif are going to detonate multiple explosive devices in the crowd and hundreds will die. Rowan stole a look at his wristwatch but said nothing. Lucy pressed on. Amarar is in disguise and only I know what he looks like. You need to help me find him before he can leave the area. She paused, marshalling her thoughts. Now, you've got a choice. You can do that, or we can sit here in this mobile doghouse and wait for the clock to run out. And when you hear the sound of that first explosion and the screams, you're going to have to look me in the eye and know you wasted the chance to stop it happening. The agent watched her, his expression stony and unreadable, and an unpleasant possibility occurred to Lucy. The Combine have people everywhere, she thought. What if this guy is in on it? She had a sudden, horrible vision of being forced to wait out those moments until the carnage began. But then Rowan leaned forward and she saw real doubt flicker in his eyes. I don't trust you. You were one of us and you broke the code. How can I believe anything you say to me? I'll make you a deal, she replied. Help me catch Amarar, and I'll tell you anything you want to know about me, about who I shot and how I ended up in Miramar. Lucy swallowed as her throat went dry. But just decide, fast, okay?
Hey!
Mark called out as he jogged across the street toward a Nissan utility van parked over from the hotel. He waved to attract the driver's attention.
Oi, mate!
The man frowned at him over the top of a newspaper that he wasn't really reading. He had spent his coffee break observing the arrival of the paramedics, scrambling to save the life of a cop who had taken an unexpected swan dive off the top of the Willard.
What?
Mark waved his stolen BBC identity card at him, panting hard. The same logo was painted in large letters along the side of the van, and the vehicle carried equipment and camera gear for the News 24 crew, currently covering the opening shots of the US election campaign.
We got a problem, Mark told the driver. I just came from the ops room, he said, pointing back at the upper floors of the Willard.
Camera just went down on the stage. I need to get in there and fix up a replacement right away. Mark walked around the side of the van and pulled on the handle of a sliding door. It stayed resolutely locked.
What?
Repeated the driver, irritated by the idea that he was going to be inconvenienced by some random glitch.
Can't they use the number two rig?
Mark banged on the door.
Mate, come on! We're going live and they need both working cameras.
I'm not supposed to go back through the cordon. I don't have authorization, insisted the other man.
And I'm on a break, he added.
Fine. You want to check in? Mark offered the driver his smartphone. Ring the ops desk, but make it quick. The driver gave him a wary look and shook his head.
No, it's okay. I can make the call.
He reached for his own company phone sitting on the dash and tapped a speed dial button that would connect him to the broadcaster dispatch. Mark made a show of impatiently turning his phone over in his fingers, but what he was actually doing was keeping it as close as he could to the driver's handset. Embedded in the casing of Mark's device was a circuit that could mimic a cellular tower at close range, forcing any nearby phone attempting to connect to the greater GSM network to talk to it, and not the nearest wireless node. Once spoofed, it was easy to channel the voice signal to somewhere other than the number that had been dialed, with the caller none the wiser.
Operations, said Cara Way's voice.
Yeah, this is Van 3, began the driver. What's this about a blown ENG rig on the live stage?
That's right. There's a guy on his way down to you. Is he there yet?
The driver shot Mark a look as Cara spun out the lie.
We need to get a replacement set up, ASAP. I've got the producer here chewing me a new one.
Got it.
The other man beckoned to Mark, reaching down to release the door lock.
On our way.
He cut the call, blew out of breath and irritably folded up his paper.
All right, let's go.
Cheers.
Mark pulled open the sliding door and was barely into the van before it pulled away from the curb and moved swiftly across the line of traffic.
Be there in a minute,
called the driver through a grill in the back of the cab.
Right.
Plastic cases arranged in racks along the inside of the van contained all kinds of equipment required for the process of ENG, electronic news gathering. But Mark ignored them in favor of a green metal box sporting a white cross. Flipping up the lid on the medical kit,
He pored through the contents and pulled out bandages, sterile wipes, and a bottle of painkillers. He shook out some ibuprofen tablets and swallowed them dry. The aftershocks from the beating Nash had given him were getting worse, and Mark was afraid that he might have cracked a rib. Wincing with a sudden motion as the van turned sharply toward Third Street, Mark rolled up his shirt and grimaced at the sight of fresh, yellow-purple bruises. He taped up his ribs, dressed the cuts, and pulled down the shirt again. The van slowed as it bounced over a speed bump by the security checkpoint, and the last thing Mark did was pull the fake police jacket from his day pack and shrug it on. He finished off the makeshift disguise with the threadbare cap that was still dirty with Turkish dust, pulling it down low to shade his face. He heard the driver talking to the police officer at the checkpoint, and then the van nosed into a parking spot among the other media trucks. Mark grabbed his pack and, before the engine fell silent, cranked open the doors at the back of the vehicle and stepped out. He dropped down and walked quickly and purposefully away, putting as much distance as he could between himself and the BBC van before the driver realized something was up. There were uniforms everywhere. Cops moved this way and that, all of them intent on their own duties, and now and then Mark glimpsed the green of a soldier's garb or the black attire of a federal agent. He kept his head down, trying not to draw attention, doing nothing that might alert those around him that he didn't belong. In preparation for the rally, everything east of 4th Street along the line of the National Mall had been cordoned off all the way down to the great reflecting pool in front of the Capitol building, forming a wide, rectangular safe zone. Along 4th, between Madison and Jefferson Drives, the main stage for the rally rose up in front of giant video screens that formed a wall, concealing the staging area and tech center that kept the spectacle running smoothly. Mark could hear the crowd on the far side of the screens clapping as the band on stage concluded their set with a racy rendition of Yankee Doodle. He felt a buzzing vibration and pulled his phone from his pocket, peering at the screen. As good as their promise, Rubicon had sent him a still image of a custom black Ford SUV. Sprouting from the roof of the vehicle were thick antennae, and various domes and pods that suggested all manner of electronic devices within. Mark turned a corner alongside a mobile generator truck and saw the exact same vehicle 100 meters away. A federal officer in a blue windbreaker was leaning on the bonnet, taking the opportunity to smoke a quick cigarette before the main event. Reaching into his pack, Mark recovered the other phone. Nash's device seemed like it was heavier, cast out of lead. On the timer screen, the numbers were still dropping. He stuffed it into his back pocket, took a deep breath, and started toward the SUV. Finally, it was only Jadid and the youth Adad. He guided him with a firm hand upon his back and wrapped around the palm in loops were his Mizbaha beads. Adad had felt the lash of them on his flesh when he had disobeyed a teacher in the orphanage. That seemed like a lifetime ago, but the sense memory of them was strong enough to remind the boy of his duty. "Stop," Jadid told him, finding the optimal spot on the far end of the arc along which all the young soldiers had been arranged. He pointed at the stage. "Look there." Adad nodded and did as he was told.
"I am thirsty."
"There will be time for that later," Jadid lied. "Do you understand how important it is for you to be here? Remember what the commander told you."
"I do," Adad replied. "I will."
He looked afraid, suddenly very young and very alone. Jadid's lips thinned. He had repeated these words over and again, and he was losing patience. "Stand strong," he snapped.
"My stomach."
Adad's hand went to his belly.
"I think I am becoming sickly, like Halil."
"No." Jadid shook his head. "That will not be permitted." Before Adad could make further complaint, he placed his hand, the hand wrapped with the beads, on his shoulder once more. "These are your orders. Defy the enemy." He had to raise his voice as the crowd applauded enthusiastically. "Look at them all around you. Cattle. Docile and fat. When we reveal ourselves, they will be in awe of us. They will fear you."
"Yes,"
Haddad replied, nodding slowly. Jadid gave a full smile.
Soon, now, the American president is coming.
He stepped back.
We will teach him a lesson,
he concluded, before turning on his heel and threading away through the crowd. He did not look back to see Adad's face, just as he had not looked back to see any of the youths. If they obeyed, and after the hard discipline that had been instilled in them he believed they would, each one would remain rooted to the place where he had been set. Qadir had plotted it out on a tourist map of the city months before. Jadid recalled standing in a Parisian hotel room with him, looking at a semi-circle of red dots around a sketch of the main stage. The positions were carefully selected to maximize the potential impact of each of the implanted devices and cause the largest possible loss of life. But the grand target would be the American leader himself. If fate smiled on them this day, he too would be cut down in the firestorm that the bombs would unleash. Jadid would have given much to remain and watch the chaos, but he knew it would be foolish to chance being caught in the dragnet that would fall in the wake of the attack. Already, he was taking a risk just being here, but it was a necessary task that, like the supervision of the other bombings, could not be delegated to someone outside the inner circle. The work was too important for him to risk capture, just as he was too important to serve the cause in so base a way as Adad and the other youths. He saw no inequality in this. It was simply the manner of things. Jadid's life would earn its full value through his continued commitment to the cause, and Adad's would be spent best dying for that same ideal. The exit to Independence Avenue was only a few moments away, and Jadid continued to make his way toward it, all smiles and contrite apologies as he pushed past the men and women he would soon see killed. The children he would soon see orphaned. The Secret Service agent looked up as Mark approached him, momentarily guilty that he had been caught indulging in a vice. The two of them were around the same height, but where Mark's build was spare, the agent was dense. He had an Asian cast to his features and a fuzz of close-cut dark hair. He made to stub out the cigarette, but Mark shook his head and made the universal gesture of begging a smoke, bringing up two fingers to his lips. The agent shrugged and reached for the packet he kept in his breast pocket. "I should quit," he offered, in a tone that made Mark think he had said the same words 100 times before. Mark quickly glanced left and right. They were not being observed. Before the agent could stop him, he stepped in close and grabbed at something on the man's belt. "Hey!" the agent recoiled, but he was up against the SUV and he had nowhere to go. He thrust out with his hand, grabbing Mark's face and squeezing, trying to shove him away. Semi-blinded, Mark couldn't see what he was doing, but he managed to complete his action through feel alone. His hand closed around the handle of a weapon and he jerked it free, fingers finding the push-button trigger. The agent tried to call out, but Mark was already forcing the metal contacts of the X2 taser into the other man's sternum. "Sorry," he told him, squeezing the trigger for a half second.
"Bah!"
The other man jerked with the power of the shock discharge, staggering as his muscles locked up and his body refused to obey his brain's commands. The agent's legs gave out and he collapsed toward Mark, knocking off his cap and almost dragging them both down with his dead weight. He wasn't unconscious, but he was barely there, shivering like a palsy victim. "Take a load off, mate," Mark offered, not unkindly, and deposited the agent on the cab step of the generator truck. Leaving him there, he sprinted back to the SUV and climbed in. From the outside, the jammer vehicle's opaque windows made it impossible to see the interior. Now Mark was inside, he was confronted by a wall of electronic systems fitted into the compact space behind the driver's compartment, all running off a big battery unit buried in the SUV's chassis. Monitors showed complex waveforms that he guessed were counter-frequencies for cellular signal carriers. Stacks of light-emitting diodes rose and fell in glowing streams as every kind of wireless communication within range was jammed into silence by a smothering blanket of artificially generated military specification white noise. The system was cutting edge. In the Fleet Air Arm, Mark had been trained to operate and recognize the functions of military ECM systems,
and in his time with MI6, he had used portable jammers on field missions. But the Secret Service rig was complex, and he didn't know where to start with it. There was no big red off switch, no power cord that he could pull, and no time to go looking for the manual. He thought about taking out the Glock and unloading the gun into anything that looked important. But outside he could see his stunned victim climbing shakily to his feet, calling out in a ragged voice. Others heard the man and came running. Mark saw them pointing toward the parked SUV, their hands dropping to their weapons. Jadid finally passed through the crush of the bystanders, and at his back the crowd became a chorus of shouts and applause. He hid away a sneer that threatened to spread across his face as he passed a group of college students no older than Adad and the rest of his soldiers. They were shouting at the top of their lungs, chanting the initials of their nation-state like it was a battle cry. Loutish, brash, and uncouth. To Jadid's mind, they were the typically overfed, over-entitled Americans he so detested. He passed them by and exited through a turnstile, glancing down the street to find Teep and the school bus. He hunched forward, pulling his collar tight, and walked quickly back to the waiting vehicle. The door was already open, and casting a last look over his shoulder, he climbed inside.
"Let's go," he commanded. "Take Second Street down to the interstate and..."
He fell silent as he looked up and saw that the driver's seat was empty. Jadid whirled, an angry retort forming on his lips. There was no time for the mercenary to play games. They were only minutes away from the first detonation.
"Jadid, Amara," said a voice he didn't recognize. "Raise your hands."
He turned and saw two figures in tactical gear crouching low along the aisle that led to the back of the vehicle. One of them had Teep pressed face down into the floor, his arms cuffed behind him and a pistol in the small of his back. The second was a woman, and she aimed her gun directly at Jadid's chest. He feigned surprise and took a step back. Jadid allowed the string of metal misbaha beads to slip from his wrist and gather in his closed hand.
"What is going on?"
"Do not take another step," said the female agent, commanding him like a mother speaking to some errant child.
"Or I will shoot you."
He hesitated on the brink of snarling out a curse at the female and saw movement outside the bus. There were other agents in bulletproof vests taking up positions around the vehicle, cutting off all avenues of escape. One of them, an older man with thinning hair, turned to speak to a younger, athletic black woman who seemed to have her wrists bound together.
"Michigan plates," he heard the man say, nodding at the bus. "How about that?"
"You believe me now?" asked the woman. Inside the bus, the female agent rose and gestured with her gun.
"Hands behind your head. Turn around and walk down to the street." "This has all been some terrible mistake," he insisted, obeying but moving slowly. "I don't know who you think I am. I am a teacher."
His jaw tensed. How had they found him? Was this Kadir's doing? Was the commander somehow displeased with him?
"Walk," said the agent. "I won't tell you again."
He gave a shaky nod and stepped back toward the door, counting down the seconds.
"I still have a chance to flee when the moment comes."
Someone was shouting at Mark to come out of the vehicle with his hands up. But then their words were lost in the brassy roar of a military band striking up the opening bars of Hail to the Chief. Without hesitating, Mark slammed the SUV's gears into drive, his hand falling to the starter button. He mashed it with his finger, but nothing happened. Mark's gaze dropped to the ignition, and he belatedly realized there were no keys in it. More people were closing around the vehicle now, other agents and cops with their pistols at the ready.
"Oh, shit."
He bent forward and played the last option he had. Securing his safety belt, Mark jammed the X2's sparking contacts against the metal head of the ignition cylinder and mashed the taser's trigger over and over, sending powerful jolts of electricity directly into the sensitive innards of the starter system, overloading it. The dials on the SUV's dashboard flickered as the engine gave a sluggish grunt, choked, and then finally turned over. Now the brass band was joined by the roar of an excited crowd, and the first report of a pistol went unheard.
Mark saw the blink of the bullet's discharge off to his right, but he felt the vehicle absorb the impact of the round as it cracked into the armored glass of the windscreen. He pressed his weight down on the accelerator pedal, and the SUV lurched forward, kicking up shreds of turf. That was all that was needed for others to open fire. Mark flinched as bullets smacked into the frame and the windows, shots that, if he had been behind conventional glass and unarmored doors, would have ended him in seconds. The vehicle sideswiped a police cruiser as it surged away, shouldering the car aside. Mark aimed the SUV at the gap between two plastic barriers and crashed through. The wheels skipped as he guided it over the sidewalk and straight across 3rd Street. Like a black missile, the jammer vehicle thundered away from the stage in the direction of the great domed Senate building. Police officers and federal agents scrambled to pursue it. More shots chopped at the tires, but the vehicle was equipped with run flats that could absorb a dozen rounds and keep going. Mark slapped at a switch on the dashboard and switched off the SUV's automatic traction control. The vehicle bounded back up off the road on the far side of the street, mowed down a temporary chain-link fence, and scrambled over the grass toward the serene mirror of the Capitol reflection pool. On the far side of the water, Mark glimpsed the grand statues of Ulysses Grant and James Garfield, silently observing the unfolding chaos. He stabbed at the button that lowered the power windows and gave his seatbelt a last tug to make sure it was secure. Something sharp cracked off the doorframe, and he guessed it was a high-caliber rifle round. Ignored it. With a savage right-left twist of the steering wheel, Mark forced the SUV into a skidding, swaying turn, then violently pulled it back in the opposite direction. With a high center of gravity, the vehicle reacted poorly and rose up on two wheels. Mark felt it pass the point of balance and start to tip, just as the front bounced over the concrete lip at the edge of the reflecting pool. He lost all sense of direction as the SUV surrendered to gravity and flipped over. Crashing through the still waters, the vehicle made one complete roll before it settled hard on the driver's side, its wheels still turning in the air. Through the opened windows, water rushed in and washed over the sensitive electronics of the signal jammers, causing brilliant discharges as short circuits flashed through the equipment. His body alight with new pain from the impact shock, Mark coughed and took in a lungful of brackish water, clawing desperately at the airbag that had blown out to smother him. The ornamental pool was less than a meter deep, but it was still enough for a trapped man to drown in. Jadid took a step away from the school bus, and suddenly he was aware of a ripple of consternation running through the assembled law enforcement officers. Voices heavy with distortion crackled through their SATCOM radios, calling out warnings across the only open channel. It was the opportunity he had been waiting for. From the corner of his eye, he saw the female federal agent raise a hand to touch the plastic earpiece she wore, her brow furrowing in concern. He made his move. Holding onto one end of the string of metal beads in his hand, he pivoted swiftly on his right foot and let the misbehar snap like a short whip, slashing them down the woman's face. She cried out and reeled back as the makeshift lash cut a bloody line across her temple and cheek. Jadid was already on her, coming in fast to loop the heavy gauge cord over her head with one hand and grab at her gun with the other. He performed the move flawlessly, a short and brutal dance as he used the beads to choke her and force the agent's weapon into the soft flesh of her bare throat.
"Get away!"
he bellowed, dragging the woman out of the line of sight of any rooftop snipers into the shadow cast by the bus.
"I will strangle this stinking whore unless you drop your guns."
"You're a class act, motherfucker."
The dark-skinned woman with the bound wrists had somehow got behind him, and he shifted, pulling tight on the beads and dragging the agent up to shield his body.
"Key, stay back," called the older man,
but she didn't acknowledge him. Jadid wanted to be in control, but he could feel that slipping away second by second, vanishing like the ticks of the countdown clock. He let out a brittle laugh.
"You will weep," he snarled. "The sword will find your throat."
The woman raised her hands in a dismissive gesture, and he saw they were strapped together with a thick plastic zip tie.
"So says the coward who sends children to die in his place." His fury peaked.
And in that moment, all Jadid wanted was to take a life. An American life, here on the hallowed streets of their capital city. To commit the first act of aggression this day, in Al-Saif's name. He turned the pistol toward the dark-skinned woman, but she was already spinning, bringing up her leg in a blur of motion. The sweeping kick cracked Jadid hard on the nerve cluster in his elbow. A shock of numbing pain ran down his gun arm and his finger deadened on the trigger. His prisoner joined in the assault and smashed the heel of her shoe down on his instep, breaking bone. Jadid cried out and she slipped from his grasp, tumbling away to the sidewalk. The woman with the bound wrists was agile despite her enforced handicap, crossing the distance to him in the blink of an eye. Her arms locked together, she sent her fists into his face as if they were propelled by a piston. Warm, wet fluid gushed from his nostrils and Jadid choked. Her foot hooked his ankle and the world turned around him, the asphalt of the road coming up to slam into his back.
No,
he managed, scrambling to get back up. No, said the older man coming into view, aiming down at him along the line of his sidearm. Where are the carriers? A ring of figures surrounded Jadid, and he coughed out a snigger. If he had to surrender, it would be with hate in his eyes.
They are already dead, he spat.
The folding multi-tool on his belt saved Mark's life. Thumbing open the blade, he used it to slice through the jammed seatbelt, holding him under the water, and pushed away, scrambling around inside the overturned vehicle. His chest was filled with jagged nails, pain slashing back and forth as he moved. Hands shaking, Mark reached up for the passenger side door and levered himself up and out. The last thing he did before rolling off the stalled SUV was to pull Nash's smartphone from his pocket, holding onto it with a white-knuckled death grip. Mark fell back into the water with a heavy splash. He rolled, soaked through, lolling against the side of the crashed vehicle, and brought the phone up to his face. People were calling out. Figures were moving on the edge of his pain-blurred vision, but he ignored them. Their shouted commands didn't penetrate his awareness, the voices very far away, strained and alien and incomprehensible. Time. Was it time? The moment seemed to pass sluggishly as he woke the smartphone with a touch and peered at the tiny screen. The 7 clocks were there, one stacked on another, 28 seconds on the uppermost, now 27, then 26, 25. The countdown was mesmerizing, and his body ached so much, the effort to lift his finger and find the button like moving an impossible weight. Arm. Safe. 0. Safe all. Mark found the tab and prodded it. There were full signal bars, full connection for as long as it lasted. He grinned weakly, imagining hundreds of people on the far side of the big screens, their phones suddenly bleating into life with the unexpected arrival of dozens of stalled calls and delayed text messages. Are you sure? Read the screen. Yes/no.
I'm sure,
he slurred, and tapped the button again. Connecting. He held his breath. The voices were clearer now, and Mark could make out figures in dark uniforms, wading through the reflecting pool toward him, an army of guns turned in his direction. Command sent, reported the device, and without further ceremony, the 7 bombs became inert, and the crowd kept clapping, and the world on the far side of the giant screens rolled on regardless. Mark didn't look up as the last 10 seconds counted down. He needed to see them fall to 0, to know for certain. But the bullet that entered his chest brought a storm of fire that shocked him out of consciousness, and Mark plunged into a drowning, chilling darkness that went on forever. The cascade of numbers, shattering like glass.